Skid Row Studios.
You're listening to 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 Skid Row Studios.
I'm not doing it with you.
Please do it with me.
Fuck that.
Can you please have sex with me?
At Skid Row Studios?
At Skid Row Studios.
Maybe.
Okay.
You are listening to Grand Theft Audio with the kings of internet radio, Jake Belcher, Grant Thoman.
You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
Right on time
for another Grand Theft Audio Radio. This is Jake Belcher.
And I'm Brent Thoman. Thanks for listening.
Here on Skid Row Studios.
Skid Row Studios in downtown Los Angeles.
All right. We've got a big show ahead of us today. We've got Jeb Cadwell live in studio, the awesome comic from the Midwest. Headline many places in from Green Bay to Madison. All over the place.
Wow.
We also have, I guess, some pretty big news going on in the last 24 hours since we've last been on the air.
Well, there's kind of been a little bit of a buzz for probably since Sunday because of what Joe Biden originally said and how he was comfortable with gay men and women being able to marry each other. Mm-hmm. And we've heard Mitt Romney come out and how he does not support that. But yesterday, really big news. The president of the United States says that he, after talking with his wife and his daughters and after some soul searching, feels that, you know, it is appropriate for men to be able to marry each other and women to be able to marry each other. So he has his platform has kind of changed. He's always everyone's kind of believed he was headed that way. But he yesterday came out and said I guess what he was really saying is that his golden rule is that, you know, to treat everybody equally is what he wants to try and be able to do. So what is your thought on this?
Totally not what I was going for. I was going to go about how Britney Spears has been confirmed as an X Factor judge.
Of course.
But
I hadn't been finalized. I thought she was still like in the running for it. So I was completely off on what your big news was. I apologize.
Oh, it's okay.
I feel alive.
Easily the best gay pride song of all time. And I'm going to pause it and restart it so that way it's just 15 second little bits.
All right, exactly.
In ecstasy, so stop me now.
Obama won't. But Mitt Romney probably will. Hey, man, like it makes Mitt Romney really look like an old, out-of-touch dude who has no idea what the pulse of America is now.
Well, especially when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002, he really was in favor of gay rights. And now he is had to backtrack on that and even had to work on legislation within Massachusetts to try and limit that after they passed the law saying it was okay for men and women to marry in the state.
So that shows me he probably really is into it, but he has political pressure telling him that this is not the best thing for you. Like, you're going to alienate your base. But it's going to alienate a lot of Obama's base, too, to say that he is for it.
Yeah.
Because, unfortunately, okay, remember a couple of years ago they had the whole Prop 8 thing, and
yep.
A whole bunch of people went after the Mormons afterwards because they're like, oh, yeah, the Mormons are the ones who voted this down. No, that is not true.
No.
It was black people because black people are totally not cool with gay people getting married. It's just that's just the way it is.
Right. I find it's usually people with a lot of very Christian-based faith where, you know, that's not appropriate, that it's not good for it's not a healthy lifestyle, and it says so in the Bible, and that they're sinners. Well, that's fine, but they're still your neighbor, and you've sinned too, and probably in front of your neighbors at some point. But they're not judging you and telling you that you can't do what you want to do.
Yeah, that's right. Most people are not trying to oppress other people all the time.
No. But, North Carolina, we were just talking about that yesterday, how they were, They put one of the strongest bans on gay marriages and civil unions. I mean, Mitt Romney doesn't even believe in civil unions.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That is really a very backwards position, in my opinion. I mean, if you really want to define marriage as between man and woman, fine. But civil unions should be allowed that have the same level of federal protection that marriage does. So, at least that's my personal opinion. The few gay friends I have, I don't see any of them wanting to get married anytime soon. It's so funny. We started off disliking gays because they were so promiscuous and the decadent lifestyle. And now that they've grown up and they want to settle down and get married, we don't like them even more.
Wait. What are you basing this on? How do you know that they have settled down and now they want to grow up?
There are those that now want, that are really pushing for this gay marriage.
There's some.
Right. And I think
I think they probably were back then too. I don't think that part has really changed.
No.
You can't say that the promiscuous lifestyle doesn't exist anymore. Now they've grown up and grown out of it.
No. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we originally disliked the American culture originally disliked the gay lifestyle because it was so promiscuous and we didn't understand it. We didn't think of it as you know right because we were raised a specific way. But now that
promiscuous, like they had sex with lots of people, and yes. That's what we didn't like about it.
Well, there was that. Yes, that's a big part of it, I think. I mean, I'm not saying me. I don't think I've ever really had a problem with gay guys. I've worked with gay guys since I was 17 years old, and you know, there were times for sure it was uncomfortable to be flirted with by a gay guy. But I'm not.
It's kind of flattering too, right?
Of course it is. It's like, hey, you know, that's really nice of you to say, but no, thank you. At no point did I feel like, oh my God, how dare you? I hate you now for that. It's like, I appreciate you saying that. It's really nice. You know, you're a nice person too. We can be friends, especially here at work, but
just not friends that rub penises against each other.
Exactly. There's no penis touching at all. So, but I'm saying, I think people who have always, who frown on homosexuality, they didn't like it because of what they believed was a promiscuous society. Now these same people, we hate them even, we dislike them even more because they want to settle down and get married like the rest of us. Like the rest of us normies, us heteros.
I don't think they really want to. I think that there's a big political push behind these things from like lawyers who want to be able to preside over weddings and divorces. And I think there's a lot of people who see it as a money-making opportunity. Because honestly, like the gay dudes I know, they don't want to get married. I mean, they're not interested in that. It's just not what they're into doing.
I know quite a few like older gay guys who have been with their partners for long periods of time who I think would like to see something that would allow them to solidify their relationship and make it something that's a little more whole that they're not allowed to because we legally don't allow them to do that right now. So I mean, it's, you're right. Younger gay guys are probably not looking to settle down, but those guys who have, after doing the young gay lifestyle and having grown up and found somebody they want to spend their life with, they can do that, but they don't have the same protection under the law, and in cases of medical issues. I mean, there's so many extra steps they have to take to make sure that the person they love can be the one that takes care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I was trying to say.
I just think making like a sweeping generalization that the gay society has grown up, and now that they like
it was meant in jest in regards to the outlook on the gay lifestyle and how we looked at it one way, and now that there are those who want to and really pushing for this gay marriage, you know, how dare they, you know, try to step on our toes and do the same thing that we already get to do?
Yeah, well, you know, you're being insensitive and even calling it gay marriage. Like, because lesbians hate that. They want it to be called same-sex marriage. Because gay really, to most people, only means between two men.
Oh, I didn't. Well, I guess so. I guess in the gay and lesbian world, you're absolutely right. That's why they're called gays and lesbians.
Yeah, that's right. They're different things.
But right.
Same-sex marriage is what most homosexuals are trying to push for.
But they won't push for homosexual marriages.
Yeah, that does sound a little weirder. I mean, it's it has the word sexual in it, and that turns people off, and they start thinking it's about different things. And
I guess so.
It's different for sure.
Yeah. Well, my apologies to anyone I may have offended by calling it a gay marriage.
I'm sure that nobody out there is really like, that's fucking Brent not saying that lesbians are equal and they should be called the same or something. I'm sure you're fine.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of lesbians listening to our show right now as it is.
I have a feeling you should go down to the streets, though, and check to make sure that no one's out there waiting to take us down right now.
No, I think we're okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty positive.
Well, I offered, right?
Thanks, man.
Okay, so that was a good point in Obama's week. I guess he's going to have an even bigger point tonight.
Yep.
He's getting together Batman, Superman.
No, not Superman. Spider-Man.
Wait, the guy who wrote Superman, right?
Yes. Okay, the writer of
Superman, Iron Man.
Yes.
Spider-Man.
Yes.
All coming together to make...
For dinner tonight.
For celebrity president man.
Exactly.
Okay, so they have a fundraiser. How much do they expect to make tonight?
They're hoping to pull in $15 million for the president's reelection campaign, and it will be the largest fundraising event the largest amount of money raised in a fundraiser for any candidate in the history of the United States.
Now, when you go to these things, I think you said the tickets for were
$40,000.
That's not that much. I mean, you see plates that are $100,000 plates at other events. How come this one is expected to raise so much more?
I think it's the fact that on top of what they're going to get for the plate dinner, for the dinner ticket price of the $40,000, there's also the opportunity to then donate more to the campaign or to the Democratic Party, whichever way they want to go, more than likely to Obama's reelection campaign. And so more checks on top of the ones signed for, because I believe it's like 150 people.
I mean, this is the event that they did like a lottery for tickets for, right?
I believe so.
And I think that that's where the majority of the cash came from for it.
Yeah, it looks like it. And that's it. Here's the fun thing. Whenever the president comes to town, the sheer delays in traffic, in air and flight delays, because there's a no fly zone in certain areas, they'll be shutting down. A good section of the 134 and 101 freeways because of where George Clooney's... Because it is at George Clooney's mansion, of course. Because
the Batcave.
Yes, the Batcave. They are good buddies. And they're going to be partying it up there. And he's going to walk out with $15 million is what they're expecting. And
wow, that is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. And it right after doing this, he's coming out to Los Angeles to an industry that has a very large percentage of gays and lesbians working in it that are very well off and will probably be donating quite a bit of extra money to the president for his reelection. So
I just think it's funny that all the superheroes are together.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of funny.
You started reading off that list to me earlier, and I'm like, hey, are they filming a Super Friends or something?
Yeah. Is it a Marvel and DC matchup in which Batman fights with Spider-Man and Iron Man? How awesome would that be?
It's the political Avengers.
Yeah, there you go. We have the political Avengers. All right, but it's just going to be it's going to tie up traffic in the area. Unless you live in the area, try to avoid Studio City.
I do that anyways.
Yeah, I know. I'm not really overly affected by it because the metros will still be running. It's not like they can stop they could stop a train if they wanted to, but I'm going to be too far underground for them to do that. I'm like the mole man in my tunnel.
That's what your superhero is today to get around it?
Yes. I'll be the mole man.
I can dig it. Though it hasn't been, those two things are good, but it hasn't really been the best week for President Obama. This last weekend, he had a political stop in Columbus, Ohio, where he's been a few times before. And he had a 14,000-seat arena. And this is the first time he's thrown an event that hasn't sold out. Only about 10,000 of the 14,000 seats were filled. And there's a lot of people who are worried if the low turnout demonstrated a lack of enthusiasm for the president.
Do people have to pay for these tickets to go see this?
Yeah.
How professional am I? I left my phone on this time. Awesome.
It's one of us every day.
Yep. Sorry about that. So they do have to pay for tickets for that.
Yes.
Well, I think that part of the problem is he's in Ohio. Was it at the Ohio State University?
No, it was at another, or off of another college.
Okay, it's another college.
Yeah.
College students can't afford to buy tickets to go see the president these days. I mean, they don't have the jobs. They ones that are right out of college are at one of the highest unemployment rates, like 16.5% unemployment, and that's that's twice what it is nationally. So mm-hmm. they don't have the money to go be able to fill up a stadium like that. What's surprising is, like, when you know how many tickets have sold and you don't have enough, wouldn't you try and find a different arena that might be smaller so it doesn't seem like it's kind of empty?
You would think that that would be a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But maybe they didn't think that this was going to happen. There'd be a lot of walk-up people at the end, or they would just hear that, oh, he's coming, so...
Hey, let's go see the president. How much is it going to cost me to see him?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the other thing that was not that great for him this week is reaction to his second political campaign ad. Let's take a listen.
Okay. 2008, an economic meltdown.
Worst financial collapse since the Great Depression.
4.4 million jobs lost.
American workers were laid off in numbers not seen in over three decades.
America's economy spiraling down.
The biggest point drop that has ever been seen in a day.
All before this president took the oath.
So help me God.
Some said our best days were behind us, but not him.
Don't bet against the American worker.
He believed in us, fought for us. And today, our auto industry is back, firing on all cylinders. Our greatest enemy brought to justice by our greatest heroes. Our troops are home from Iraq. Instead of losing jobs, we're creating them. Over 4.2 million so far. We're not there yet. It's still too hard for too many. But we're coming back because America's greatness comes from a strong middle class. Because you don't quit, and neither does he.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Okay, first of all, before we get into it, when did that part have to become part of a political ad where you do the, I'm whatever my name is, and I approve this message?
Because there's the super PACs that can put out anti ones that, and there are super PACs that can put out ones that are pro you, but they're not saying what you want them to say.
But you're not approving it?
Right. You haven't approved what they're saying. These people are saying, we're asking you to vote for President Obama because of this, and this is why we think so. That's what these super PACs can do. But if Obama doesn't agree with everything that's being said in that message, he doesn't have to approve it. And by not approving it, he's not really doing anything wrong. And it's not really changing any positions. It's just these are the positions of this super PAC. So when he says, this is Barack Obama and I approve this message, it's one that has been gone through by... his press secretary, so many people, the wording, everything about that is so well scripted so that it comes across as these are the exact points we want you to understand. And then he gets the final say on it, and then he approves it. And it's thusly saying, this is mine and this is my position. The others mean that maybe that's not what his position really is.
Well, here's the thing, that this is mine and this is my position. I mean, the whole first half of that is about, things really sucked when I took over as president.
Yep.
I mean, like the stock market wasn't doing very good, and we were at a war with somebody, and I didn't even know what to do.
Basically, I didn't think it came across as
it is
quite
that whiny to me. I mean, the beginning is very, very whiny.
Economic meltdown.
Worst financial. Yeah.
Economic meltdown.
Indeed.
Collapse since the Great Depression.
Which is absolute bullshit. I mean, okay. During the Great Depression, people were fucking dying of starvation on the streets.
They said since the Great Depression.
Okay,
so they're not saying it's as bad as the Great Depression, but it is the biggest economic recession that we've seen since that time.
I can see comparing it to the Carter administration, what was going on then when people were having to stand in line for gasoline and having.
Well, we were standing in gasoline because OPEC wasn't producing gasoline and letting us. That's why prices got out of control. We didn't have a supply of it.
Well, we're still talking about world issues,
yeah,
and how it affects the populace.
Right. 4 million jobs lost.
American workers were laid off in numbers not seen in over three decades.
America's.
Three decades.
That's the 70s. Yeah.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Is like they're saying that this economic recession is bigger than the one in the 70s, and we haven't seen job loss like this since in 30 years, since the 70s. So, I mean, it does come across as kind of, saying, hey, don't forget that it's not, I walked into this the way it was, and I'm trying to fix it. I'm asking you for some more time. That's what it all comes across to me is like, I've been doing my best. I got handed a shit hand. Now I'm trying to get us a new hand dealt and see if we can improve things. So please give me more time. Give me FOMO.
It is bitchy, though. I mean, instead of just really focusing on what he can change and what he can make better, the whole thing is about how, I didn't get the best shake coming into this job.
Right.
Kind of offensive to
me. Hey, you know what? Reagan got cast a shit hand because when he took over for Carter. and he turned us around. So, I mean, I'm not saying, but at no point did Reagan ever have to say that, you know, have to remind us of what times were like. We know what times were like back then.
This is true.
I mean, it's not that far out of our memory.
And we know what times are like right now when it's time to head off to our first musical break of the show.
Awesome.
This is Your Body by Mae McDonough and Company. Thank you. I clicked some type of wrong button, and now I got sound coming out from the wrong holes. Hey, this is Jake Belcher.
And I'm Brant Thoman.
And I'd like to introduce our first guest of the day. This gentleman is a stand-up comic from... plays all over the Midwest, all over America, really, touring all over the place. And he hit me up recently, and he's friends with a whole bunch of other friends of the show. I'm like, okay, I usually don't check out people who just kind of hit us up. But I started looking into him and thought he was hilarious.
All right.
And super glad to bring him in. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jeb Cadwell.
Thank you. Hooray.
Hooray.
Yeah, I did it. I made it. Thank you.
You certainly did. How are you this fine morning?
Excellent. Excellent.
You're now on the elite list of the Grand Theft Audio Radio.
Yes.
Interviews.
That's awesome. Wonderful list of people, too. A lot of my good friends.
Yeah, we've been pretty proud to bring in most people we've brought here. So, big day going on in the news. We'll kind of get back into you when we in a couple minutes, but sure. We're in our news thing. You follow, pay attention to yesterday's Obama coming out saying that he was...
well, not Obama coming out.
You're right. He's still closeted as far as we know. But he's coming out and saying that he's in favor of gay marriage.
Yeah, that's how he's doing it.
It's pretty surprising that to me that at least that he would like kind of say this early. I thought he would save it for like the last debate and just drop it in there or something cool at the end, and people would be like, "Whoa, that's the last thing that's going to put him over the top for me."
Yeah, well, I think Biden's comments kind of forced it a little bit.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then everyone's been waiting for him. He did that big dinner about 6 months ago, mm-hmm. the big fundraiser, and at the end of it, he was very inconclusive. So. It's kind of forced.
Yeah, he's been a little bit hard to get a straight answer out of on him. I don't want to say straight answer. It sounds gay too. It's almost hard to do the story without innuendo after innuendo.
It's been fun though.
Yes, that's mostly true.
Yeah, he could have done gay immigration reform. Could have done two at once.
That'd have been great. Yeah. You can kind of have like the whole McDLT thing where you have like the hot side and the cold side. You put it together and it's perfect.
Yep.
You can have two issues that you don't see normally go together and people are like, mwah, it's beautiful. Yeah. It's delicious.
That does sound good. You know what, man? I remember the McDLT. You were talking about Obama and you bring up the McDLT and I was like, man, I wish they still made that.
It was a good burger.
It was a great burger. And I loved the packaging with the one side hot and one side cold.
I really don't know why they get rid of it.
The styrofoam packaging, I think, was what made it so that you could do that.
They couldn't do it with cardboard?
I don't know. It didn't seem like they could. Although they did, they switched up those Big Mac. I remember they used the Big Mac ones when they were styrofoam.
I mean, everything was styrofoam at McDonald's a long time ago.
Yeah. I don't think even the coffee cups are anymore.
Yeah, I think there's some biodegradable mishmash of garbage. Yes.
Eco-friendly. Way to go, McDonald's.
So how long have you been out here in L.A.?
Been out here a little over a year. Been came directly from Chicago. So it's been an interesting experience coming out here.
Would you consider like Chicago to have been your home base before all this?
Yeah. Move? Yep. I grew up mostly in New Hampshire. And so...
Now, that is something I've never been told by anyone.
I
don't think I've ever been told that somebody grew up in New Hampshire.
It's I think I'm the only one that got out.
Is there a big, like, big comedy scene in New Hampshire?
Huge comedy scene.
It's such a big state, too.
I know what it's up. Yeah, I lived in Chicago for almost 12 years. And before that, even though I grew up in New Hampshire, I moved, I think, 20 times before I was 18 years old.
Wow.
So,
why so many times?
Well, my mom's a dreamer. She's a writer. Mm-hmm. And so she's also an idealist. So every time she would read or be inspired by any author from any place in the country, she'd think, that's where the grass is the greenest. So we'd move. We moved constantly. Wow. And then...
What was your favorite place you moved to along that time? Does any of them stand out?
Yeah, actually, I went to high school partially in Santa Cruz. So that was...
Hell yeah.
I was going to say, at some point, you must have made your way out to the Northwest.
Yeah.
And Santa Cruz, of course, lands right there. Nice.
That was wonderful. And then when they got moved back to New Hampshire, a lot of moving in the same school district. So even though I mostly associate with the East Coast, I lived in Chicago continually longer than anywhere else. And so that's where I dug in.
How about places you liked the least?
I hitchhiked a lot around the country as well. I was, I know.
Wow.
As a kid, I was inspired a lot by Jack Kerouac and my mom, you know, always being a literary wanderlust person. So the hitchhiking, kept me in different areas for a couple months here and there. So the The least favorite place I think I've been was Gallup, New Mexico. And I was just passing through. Got dropped off on the intersection of 40 and Route 666. Spent a couple of days there.
That sounds like an awful place.
Yeah, it is.
I've been to New Mexico once in like the big city there, and it was just a drag.
The big city. Yeah, that's Albuquerque,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Pretty
I remember pulling into that town and just going, so this is Albuquerque. Mm. All right. Yeah. And that was Albuquerque. And as I was on my way to Colorado. So
yeah, that's how you do it. Yeah. But yeah, I spent a few days there. I was actually jumping trains. This is before I got into stand up, when I was traveling around doing a lot of hiking and camping and train jumping.
You were a hobo.
I was a hobo.
That's awesome. Yes, yes. I have never met a real hobo.
Who then moved to Chicago and spent 10 years doing Second City theater and stand up. So it was a real mix. And in all the improv classes and shows, you always played a game called Hitchhiker. Mm-hmm. You get in a car, you take
one
on
of our favorites. Yes.
you take on the persona of the person that whose car you got in. So, but that was my life for about 6 years. So getting in a car, people being like, I hate these hippies. They don't want us to cut down trees. And I'd be like, I know those people. And then the very next ride, you know, it'd be like,
I can't believe they want to cut down all these trees.
Yeah, I know.
I love
horrible.
It. Hey, you want to smoke some weed?
And my personality became like tofu for, you know, just taking on the driver.
That certainly sounds like it'd be the easiest way to get yourself across country with hitchhiking. You would never just agree with everything the driver says and just go with that.
It gets you in trouble. I was, one time I was hitchhiking from, I went to college in Arizona, it's a little town, Prescott. So I was hitchhiking from Santa Fe to Prescott through Albuquerque. Got picked up by this guy who was driving this beater old car. And as we're driving, I'm learning the dude doesn't have any, doesn't have a license, doesn't have a registration. the dude didn't have any money.
There's two keys of cocaine in the trunk that he's trying to get there so that he can get the money.
No license, no registration.
Oh, he didn't have keys. I remember he was like, well, if we stop the car now, I'm going to have to redo this hot wiring thing. But we got to go to a church to get some money so I can get gas to go further. And, oh, it's getting dark. We better stop. I'm legally blind and I don't have any glasses. So
how is he going to get money from a church?
That's what a lot of people, like travelers, do. They just, you know, pull up, get vouchers for gas and food and so forth.
I didn't even know that existed.
I didn't do that. I was a proud hobo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I didn't take any handouts. I didn't ask for your food when you came out of a restaurant.
How did you decide that hitchhiking and stuff like this was a good idea?
I'm gonna jump to 2 days ago.
Okay.
When I heard a quote by Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. He said that before you sit down and write, it's important to stand up and live. So just I was 18, 17, mm-hmm. getting out of high school, thinking I want to be a writer. I want to write I love stories. I want to convey the power of experience and transformation. I am a hippie after all. But I hadn't had any experiences other than traveling with my mom and my sisters and so forth. So I was like, got to get out and live. So I do it. Plus, also being kind of low rent increases the travel. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I don't have never had a lot of cash. So mm-hmm. if I want to get point A to point B and have more mm-hmm. pleasure, mm-hmm. I'm gonna, you know, stick my thumb out or make it happen somehow.
When's the first time you actually threw it out there?
The first time I threw it out there, I was actually only 16 years old, and I had a buddy that said he was getting me a job. We were gonna go down to Martha's Vineyard for the summer, and So I had money in the bank too, just a little bit. But my buddy's name was Taj. Was like, no, don't worry, I got you covered. Till we get down there, start landscaping, make some money. We jumped on a bus from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, got down to Boston, and he was like, oh, I don't have any money. I'm so sorry. So I have my bus ticket that's gonna get me all the way there, and I was kind of like, well, I'll hitchhike the rest of the way. So I got out in downtown Boston, and I was all excited, 16 years old, went to a store where they sold office supplies and asked if I could borrow a Sharpie, made a sign that said Martha's Vineyard, like someone's driving like directly there, like over the water. And it took me a while. It took me like half an afternoon to get down there. On the way, I took the Boston Transit to a little town just south of Boston. One of my sister's best friends, so childhood friends of mine as well, in the car with her parents, drove right past me. And, you know, but we have a policy. We don't pick up hitchhikers.
Wow,
it's so weird.
Even
yeah.
Knowing you. Wow.
Here I'm 16. And I got in trouble with the cops on the way down there and everything. They you know, they took me in for, you know, are you running away from home? My mom was like, let the kid go.
Yeah.
No, he has permission.
He's trying to come up with some life experience.
When's the last time you hitchhiked?
The last time I hitchhiked was, had it been 2002. I was already living in Chicago, already doing a lot of sketch comedy, a lot of stand-up. I wasn't touring yet, and I took a little break to visit some friends in Colorado. I had friends in Denver and down in by Durango, so hitchhiked, kind of did a little zigzag through the right through the mountains, right through South Park, and South Park, Colorado is in it's not a town, it's actually a region. So went right through there, had some breakfast, got picked up by a guy whose car then broke down right out in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of interesting.
Awesome.
So that was all planned. I always had a backpack, sleeping bag, and I was ready to camp out. But then right as it was getting dark, a woman picked me up and drove me all the way to my destination.
Any like really worrisome travels with it? Any time where you just were just like, I can't believe I just got into this car with this person and I can't wait to get out of it?
Yes. Yes. Would you like to hear about that one?
Hell, oh, yes. I was just asking. I know. The next question.
Yeah, yeah. When's the segment over? I'll tell you about that. I was one of the weirdest. There's a few that are really similar, but one of the weirder experiences was I was probably 19. I was going to college in Prescott, Arizona. Summer vacation hit. I was hitchhiking up to through Flagstaff up to near Boulder, Colorado, and I got picked up by a dude, and it was only like 5 miles away from where I'd been living. And I get in the car, it's getting dusky, and I'm, you know, he's kind of a short Hispanic dude. He's kind of driving an old beater. And I look out the window to my right, you know, just looking at the view, it's like, ah, thanks for picking me up. And I look back over, think I see something down, like he's, you know, got his coffee mug between his leg. Maybe he's just drinking a little coffee. So he's got his hand down there. That wasn't the case. And so, yeah, guy's basically pleasuring himself on the route. So I did the old double take. I look out the window, and I was like, no, you didn't. And here I am. I'm like, I am, yeah, big old kind of dreadlocky, hippied out hair. But I just turned, you know, fists up in the air. You know, let me out now. Like I was going to smack the guy. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry. It's just been a really difficult day at work, you know, like that's his excuse, you know.
And you're
that's
such
actually
a cute
what he said.
White boy.
What's that?
And you're such a cute white boy. Yeah, I just couldn't help myself.
Yeah. It was creepy. No cute white boys at work. Like, oh gosh, difficult day at work.
Creepy.
So yeah, so I just, you know, I had the fist up and I got all violent. I got all like aggro. So he pulled over and I got out of the car and he pulled up a little bit. I had a boot knife. That's how I did it. I was hitchhiking, so
you have sound.
I was like, I held it up in the air like I was, I don't know, Road Warrior or something. Uh-huh. Like, get out of here. I'm flashing the knife. And he's, you know, meanwhile parked like 15 feet up the street for a few minutes. You know.
Finishing.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So his car was a beater and so was he. Uh-huh. That's all.
Hilarious.
He kept hoping you were going to change your mind. He was sitting there. Right. Come on, please come back.
So yeah,
I'm
was
not
a,
so bad.
That was a weird one. But sometimes that kind of affection and was a little less dramatic. One time I was picked up by a dude. I was up in New Hampshire hitchhiking down to central Massachusetts. The guy picked me up, this old lobster farmer. Guy was probably in his 70s, you know. Ah, has anyone told you you've got the most beautiful blue eyes? Actually, yeah, that's not quite a main accent. Uh-huh. But I was like, yes, I got to go. And that's how.
Yes,
that's
many women have told me that. Thank you so much. I'd like to get out of the car now.
There's a Hispanic guy in Arizona. He thinks I got somebody. Some blue eyes will hook you guys up.
Yeah, so, I can't imagine hitchhiking. I've done it probably for a grand total of a mile and a half in my life.
What was the reason?
The bus didn't pick me up, and had to get down to the show. So I went out in the middle. I ran out in the middle of the show until like the street. I'm like, someone give me a ride down the street. Someone give me a ride down the street. It took 30 seconds to find somebody. I felt like I was pretty lucky because you hear stories of people sit out there for 5-6 hours waiting for someone
hours,
to come by.
Days sometimes.
What's the longest you've ever had to wait for a ride?
Dude, I am an idiot, and I'll tell you guys this. This is the theme of half of my stand-up, too, is I'm just trying to make the right decision, and I do something just one little brainless moment just causes a whole kind of downfall.
Shit cavalcade.
Yep. So one time I was on Grateful Dead tour, and I was up in Portland, Oregon, and I ended up catching a ride down to San Francisco with a friend, and then I was going to hitchhike back to Prescott, Arizona. And I made a sign that said Prescott, Arizona. Like I homed in right on the destination instead of like keeping it vague, you know, like south. And it just said Prescott, Arizona. And I was down to like 10 bucks. I would do odd jobs and I'd be on the road and stuff like that. But I was down to like no money. I was like, I got to get back home where I had friendly couches. And I must have waited on the off ramp for like, or the on ramp for like 2.5, 3 days, just kind of camping and waiting. And then finally, like 3 days into it, someone pulls over. I was like, finally. And the guy was like, dude, you're going to Arizona? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, you're on the on ramp heading north. The on ramp you're at goes back to Portland.
Wow. Like,
Yeah.
So you go to the other on-ramp then, and then how long did it
30
take?
30 seconds later, he gets in a car and drives home.
Yeah, and I knew the people. It was my friend Zoe from New England. It was her parents that passed me by 8 years earlier.
Really?
No, that's a very forced callback.
Okay, there you
go.
But that'd be amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, so it was a hip, hop, skip, and a jump. I don't talk about any of this in my stand-up. It's interesting. When I do stand-up for the 4 or 5 years I toured, a lot of times I'd be in kind of hellhole gigs, a lot of B clubs, C clubs, one-nighters and so forth, where the attention span is pretty short, and I'd be the feature doing a half hour, sometimes a little longer, but I'd always need to kind of feed them some kind of punchline every 7 seconds, and usually lowest common denominator, work, sex, partying, or something like that. And so I was able to do it, but as soon as I started telling these stories, which were more outlandish but true, they wouldn't believe it. They have to believe the premise first and get to know me. So it was something I always kind of shied away from until very recently here doing 10, 20-minute little short showcases in Los Angeles.
So when did you decide to start doing stand-up?
I started writing stand-up this whole time. When I was on the road hitchhiking, I'd be writing jokes the whole time. I had a profound dislike of urban places, and so I never really came in and worked it out. But when... So it was a really slow genesis. I was working on a farm. I ended up working on a farm upstate in New York, and we would go down to Manhattan and sell our produce a couple times a week. So I ended up staying down there and hitting open mics and so forth, and it was working out really well. Then I went to Vermont, which is where my sister's living, and had some friends, and started doing shows in Burlington, which was great, 4 shows a week in a club there. But it was all just kind of very light, not too. Well, nobody's going to see me in Burlington.
Uh-huh.
And then, it was kind of slow. I had to really just get over it, move to Chicago eventually. Very slow genesis, that's the short answer.
So are you a driver now that you're here in Los Angeles? Do you have a car?
I do.
Now, do you pick up hitchhikers?
No.
Very interesting.
Now, I would never pick up hitchhikers in an urban place.
Well, no. But I mean, if you were like saying, let's say you're going to be going on a trip to, say, San Diego for a show, and you see somebody along the side of the road who needs to ride down to San Diego.
I have to play it by ear, see what they look like. And I'm a married dude now. And so some decisions I'd make on my own, you know, it's
totally
fine.
Totally understand that.
Yeah.
I recently married myself.
Yeah, I heard that on the show. Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you as well. It's like, it does change how the risks you're willing to take.
Yeah.
Because before I didn't give a shit. I mean, I would just do whatever. And if something bad happened to me, tell my mom I loved her.
Yeah.
But now it's... there's just so much more bad things that could happen to someone else because of what I do.
Yeah. So, like, I've picked up more hitchhikers than hitchhiked. I mean, I've had to, like, in Mammoth, at the bottom of the hill, my car just cut out. And it was nighttime, it was snowing, and I just stood there next to my car, basically at the off-ramp of 395, and just sat there for a good 45 minutes in the cold, and finally somebody picked me up and took me into town. And then I had a buddy help me get my car back the next morning by giving me a tow, but... that's about the longest, I think 3 miles into town is the longest amount of hitchhiking I've had to do. But I have picked up hitchhikers before. I mean, like, especially when I was coming, it wasn't exactly hitchhikers. It was people who were friends of friends who needed rides. And I was kind of being hit up, but they were talking about hitching a ride somewhere. So I was like, well, I'm headed down south. If you want to kick in 10 bucks for gas, I'll get you down to Los Angeles, wherever you need to get to. Then there was one time just outside of Mojave. There was a guy sitting on the side of the road, looked pretty bad, but it's like, okay, he's a single guy, doesn't have much, there's not a lot of luggage. Sure, I'll take a chance. Pulled over, he's like, hey, can you get me to Lancaster? Well, that's perfect, that's on my way there. And so we're driving, and about 10 minutes into it, I look over, And he's smoking crystal meth in the car.
Oh, no.
Wow. And he's like, you want some? Oh. I'm like, no, dude, I'm straight. Thanks. I just like to smoke weed, but thanks very much. And he's like, yeah, this stuff's great. It doesn't smell or anything, so the cops can't bust you for it. It's like, yeah, no, no. So we get to Lancaster, and he's like, okay, can you drop me off at this place? I take him to this one place, and he gets out of the car, and he's like, could you hold on just a quick second? Runs, gets some of the stuff out of his bag, and it, apparently he had stolen some tools and was now trying to sell them to friends of friends who he knew were in the construction trades and was trying to sell off like some saws and drills and shit like that. And that didn't work. So, well, can you take me to the other place? I said, dude, I can drop you off at that other place or I can drop you someplace else, but I have to get going. I have plans in Los Angeles this evening. Would that be okay?
Yeah.
Oh, are you sure? It's like, really, dude, I got to get gone. It's like, all right, well, just drop me off here. But that's the scariest, but it's just looking over and all of a sudden, holy shit, the dude's like smoking crystal meth in my car. What the fuck's he doing?
Were you afraid of like secondhand meth?
No, no, because as soon as I saw him do it and I rolled my window, I was like, oh, you don't have to worry about that. I was like, I don't care what you say. I'm rolling down my fucking window. And now, granted, after I got him out of the car, I decided, okay, I'm going to smoke a bowl of weed, and then I'm going to drive that last little bit because I want to get this shit out of my brain.
I want to
be mellow and like, okay, that was the craziest hour and a half of my life so far. Well, maybe not the craziest, but one of the craziest hour and a half of my life. It was just nuts.
That's nutty.
So,
I don't have the guts to pick up a hitchhiker. Like, even like some hot chicks would be on the side of the road who are hitchhiking. I'd be like, no, I don't trust them.
I have done that once. It was a really cute chick, and she just needed to get like 20 miles. And it's like, I'm going that direction anyway. Let's go. But I mean, never got anything out of it other than a thank you. But you know, when she was dressed really nicely, so it's like, I'll get to look. That's fine.
That's it. I've had a couple of really hot chicks offer me sex on the road. A few of them, but I'm conservative. One of them was actually crazy. I was hitchhiking. I was going from Durango, Colorado. I was going to go hike the John Muir Trail. It's 400-mile trip. And I had this Beater old Datsun thing was breaking down the whole time. I'd have to stop every 50 miles to get a rag and tighten my own spark plugs.
Wow.
Yeah. And so
not
I see
good.
This. I know. And I know I'm running down on my money. Actually, I jumped forward after this whole chick experience happened. I dropped her off. My car broke down in Death Valley. And I ended up abandoning it. But before that, I picked her up, tall blonde. Wearing like the hippie skirt and like almost nothing on top, attractive. And then, but she was completely schizophrenic. And the story kind of unveiled that she had this story in her head where she believed that she was being followed for her whole life by these people. She said that when she was a kid, she witnessed a murder at a rest stop and the murderers had been following her whole life. And so we'd pass by somebody and they'd have like a blue hat on and she'd be like, "Ah, speed up. No, wait, take this right. We got to hide. It's the blue symbol. It's the blue symbol." And she was on this quest. It was almost like she was on her own psychotic scavenger hunt. She's like, "I got to go to Las Vegas and ride a water slide. And then the universe is going to give me another message. And after that, I got to get a letterhead of information from Bakersfield." And like all this weird stuff. And she had just come from a used bookstore in Florida where she had to pick up a clue to.
What an interesting quest, though. I've got to get to a water slide in Las Vegas. Like, this is actually just on my vacation, but this is how I'm going to go about it. I got all these little clues. Once I get there and do that, the universe is going to tell me that I got to go to Bakersfield.
I know. She had to get a letterhead from like the Air Force or something. I don't know how her brain worked. But then she offered me sex if I'd wait for her to ride the water slide. I said, "I'll be leaving right now. You don't want to be mixed up in this one." And so you do that. So.
I don't want to just go ride the water slide.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like more fun.
You know, I don't want the sex, but can I go with you on the water slide? That'd be great. That'd be so much fun.
I did the math. I was like, ooh, getting to that water slide is going to be 3 tightenings of the spark plug. So I got to keep going.
Uh-huh.
So that was that.
It is weird the way you have to measure things out in the world like that. So you said you went and to go walk the John Muir Trail. Did you actually go through that experience?
Yeah, absolutely. It was wonderful. A lot of these stories after high school, when I went to college in Prescott, Arizona, I actually studied a couple of things. One of them, wilderness survival and group leadership. So one of my first jobs coming out of college was working with youth at risk in wilderness settings. And that's actually really where...
Like an outward bound type of thing?
Yep. One of them, the programs I worked for was called Wolf. It was through the YMCA. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. And that's the campfire nights, storytelling nights, and so forth with the youth at risk are a lot of what encouraged me to get into stand-up. The kids would always be like, dude, Jeb, you gotta do this, man. You gotta hit this. So what was your first question?
It was about walking the John Muir Trail.
Oh, yeah. So the college in Arizona I went to, it was all about wilderness experience. So for months at a time, we had to live with a five-pound bag of grain, feed, and a tarp and a sleeping bag. So it was easy to walk the John Muir Trail, very pleasurable.
It just seems like it's something that not many people are into now. I mean, did you run into a lot of people on the trail, or is it a pretty isolated experience?
I was with a couple buddies, and we took, when I met up with buddies after my car broke down in Death Valley, and I hitched a ride in the back of a semi truck with the furniture, got there, was with buddies, and we ended up taking some shortcuts, basically just cutting right off the trail, going through overpasses where we wouldn't see anybody for days. But then when it was during the summer, so when we were down on the trail, we'd see all kinds of
trails. Really the only time of the year you can do it.
Yeah.
how long did it take you? Because I know it's 400 miles. It usually takes about a month.
Yeah, we spent 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
So every couple of weeks we'd come across some, you know, kids with dirt road where there'd be a ranger station where I had already pre-mailed my food.
So oh,
I'd
cool.
pick it up. I brought, my buddies come from more wealthy families where their parents actually made them dehydrated soup and, you know, all the stuff to go. But what I did, I went to a co-op and I was like, 5 pounds of quinoa, 5 pounds of oats, 5 pounds of falafel mix. I'm good to go. And that was mine for the month. But I also was catching my own fish. So I supplemented for my diet by cooking, which was nice. My friends didn't like it.
Probably really started to enjoy trout.
Yeah, the easiest, so easy to catch up.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Why is a trout easier to catch?
That's predominantly what's in the creeks. John Muir Trail is up by Yosemite. It goes through Yosemite and all over the eastern Sierras. So the predominant fish is going to be trout, whether brown, brookie. Mm-hmm.
Golden.
Did you catch one? I haven't gotten my golden yet. I've caught the other three, the rainbow, the brookie, and the brown. But
I did not catch a golden.
Yeah, my father has only caught one, and that was several thousand feet higher than we usually would go. He went off on a 3-day trip with some friends, and he caught one. I hope to someday be able to do the same thing, because I used to be a much more avid fly fisherman, and just a little tougher to do that here in Southern California, especially when you don't have a car.
I don't even know how you get to that point. Like, I'm such a little digital media baby. Right, the idea of getting away from any technology for any extended amount of time, that scares me more than hitchhiking. That is not something I would be good at.
I will say that when my parents would take us off on like our 2-week vacations up to the Eastern Sierras, there was the technology we had were radios. That was it. Yeah. I mean, I grew really fond of the radio in the summers because I'd be able to listen to baseball. I'd be able to listen to music. I'd be able to kind of keep in touch a little bit with the outside world, but there was no media other than that. And you created your own media. You found big logs to cut in half so you had a good fire the next night.
Yeah, that was our media. That's how we do it. Yeah, we would make chess boards out of the dirt, and, you know, these pine cones were the kings and so forth. So that was our...
That idea I could dig.
Yeah.
But it just seems like... how long ago was it that you did this?
That must have been 97 or 98. So I was already just writing tons of stand-up, but it took me a long time to be able to get up the gumption to go out and do it. So, yeah. I ended up, one thing that really kind of pushed me over the edge when I was doing all that hiking, toward the end of that trip, I ended up going up to Northern California, getting involved with some environmental protesters trying to protect the headwaters, basically the redwood trees and so forth. And we did these protests, got intentionally arrested, and so forth, and so as media events.
Okay, that sounds very interesting.
Sounds like another segment.
Yeah, it certainly does. So we're going to go to our second musical break of the day. This, once again, is Mae McDonough and Company. This is called The Camel's Song. You can check out more of her at maemcdonoughandcompany.com.
And they are our Grand Theft Audio Band of the Week.
They will be here live in studio tomorrow at 10 a.m. So check this out and enjoy.
The audio or video recording.
You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
I'm not doing it with you.
Please do it with me.
Fuck that.
Can you please have sex with me?
At Skid Row Studios?
At Skid Row Studios.
Maybe.
Yo, Brant, give me a... You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
You are listening to Grand Theft Audio.
On Skid Row Studios.
With the kings of internet radio, Jake Belcher, Brant Thoman.
And some other guy who is no longer with us. Hey, this is Jake Belcher.
And I'm Brant Thoman.
We are back live on the studio with Jeb Cadwell. Before we went to our break, you're talking about doing protests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was, I spent a lot of time hiking. I spent actually for almost 8 years, didn't really live anywhere, moving around. And at the tail end of that, I got involved with environmental protests up in Northern California. We got intentionally arrested, which was good for media, and a lot of sordid tangents and stories therein.
What type of things were you protesting against?
We were one of the things we were protesting against was called the salvage rider, and it was passed along through Congress with a bill that was going to get aid to the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. So
it does sound worth protesting.
Oh, yes, it does. Well, no, they don't get aid. Well, the salvage rider, what they did was they were like, oh, you know, so we got to get aid to these poor families and the victims. Oh, and be able to do logging that overrides the fresh air, the clean water, the sacred sites, the endangered species, all these other
acts. One of those things where they try to make something that sounds like it's great, but they sneak in all these things that are actually effing you in the A underneath it.
Right? Yeah, pretty horrible.
So, sneaking it in, really. Just, I mean, at the last minute, oh, we're going to attach this little rider.
Oh, yeah, it has nothing to do with the other thing.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, protesting against that. And so I was also fly fishing. So when I was up in Northern California up by the Klamath River, that's where I happened upon the protesters and so forth, and got involved. So one of them... one of the guys, actually, I don't know, it was in the news quite a while ago, but a woman, Julia Butterfly, who sat up in a redwood for like a year and a half.
Right.
So my buddies and I were the ones that helped set that up. We were the ones who got that operation started. So we did that kind of stuff. And basically, we didn't damage any equipment or anything, but we just created a lot of hubbub so that the media would get there and so forth.
I mean, how did you first realize that, hey, we have to get arrested to actually be able to do this?
Well, I realize it when someone goes, hey, do you mind getting arrested? No, man, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, my
what
arrest.
What a great idea. Let's totally go do that.
Yeah, man, that's good. This won't affect anything.
Uh-huh.
It was actually, it was fun. I'll say that. It was a little dangerous, a lot dangerous, actually, when I got arrested. I climbed up into a yarder. It's like a crane that they use to get logs off of steep slopes and, you know, stopped the operation for a day and a half, 2 days. And then, when I came, then at the last minute, I was like, I don't think I want to get arrested after all. So I actually climbed down and dodged around the cops and escaped. But then they caught me a little bit later down in the ravine. So when I ended up going to court, it was down in Sacramento. And the odd thing was that the Unabomber had his court in the same day, the same courthouse and everything. So that whole week I had to go back for little court things, and all the papers I saw were like, the United States versus Theodore Kaczynski, room 1A. United States versus Jeb Cadwell, 2B. I was like, this is funny.
Did you get a photo of that?
You know what? I grabbed some of the paper.
Awesome.
Yeah, but then I was kind of like, oh, I'm going to write letters on the back of this to my friends. Uh-huh. You know, just like, check this out, so I have no proof. But being stuck down there for so long, In Sacramento, I ended up staying with friends of friends, and so I was housed, and it was very pleasant. It was the first time I really stayed in a nice environment, a house, for years. And so I was like, oh, this is nice. But they were like, hey, you should start doing that stand-up you've been writing. So I took advantage of open mics, kind of being around the hood.
Now, is that part of the evolution of you moving down to L.A. and start taking it more seriously?
Yeah, pretty much. That was before the farmers markets in New York, though. I got hurt. I got pretty hurt when I was up there in the mountains. I fell off a cliff, broke some ribs. Initially, couldn't use my legs. Wow. Well, only for a little while. And then,
dude, I mean, what's it like when you can't move your legs? I mean, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking, I hope the cops don't catch up.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, the sensation came back pretty quickly, but I was pretty injured.
Uh-huh.
And when I was laying at the bottom of that ravine, I was thinking, gosh, there's got to be a better way to make a positive difference in this world. And so, you know, for me, it is about storytelling and comedy. I heard another quote, when people laugh, they listen. And so laying at the bottom of that ravine, I was hoping my feeling in my legs would come back, and I was already starting to change my plan. So I ended up, the job I had in New York on the farmer's market was part of my, like, mellow, let's kind of get healed a little bit and have a steady kind of life. And that's when I started checking into stand up more regularly and so forth.
Let's grow up a little bit and stop jumping off of cliffs.
Yes. Yeah. And trains.
Yeah.
And so forth. Yeah. The evolution that moved me to Chicago for 12 years was actually when I got to Bakersfield, the letterhead on the universe told me it was time to go. So I went to a lot of different places, but basically, after I was the farm, New York, and then that's when I went to Vermont and started really doing a lot of stand-up. But I had to go somewhere. So Second City Touring Company came through Vermont. I was like, these are my people. A sketch comedy, this is it. I was like, this exists. This is what I grew up on, Saturday Night Live. This is what I've been writing, just smart, hilarious, real, truth in comedy. And so I was like, those are my people. So I moved to Chicago. I was only planning on staying for a few months. I was going to take some basic improv classes. And then I already had connections that liked my stand up, said they'd take me on the road with them. But I fell in love with the sketch comedy and ended up spending six years solid just doing sketch and improv nightly. And I really got away from stand up during that time. And,
A lot of people on the outside don't see them as being that different of a thing. Like, you think, oh, it's just comedy. Like, you can do one or the other. But they are vastly different.
Yeah, they are. I think that improv and sketch, improv helps stand-up. But stand-up hurts improv. That's my experience. If you have a lot of improv skills, we're used to just being in the moment. Just mm-hmm. playing by the genuine reaction that our characters or ourselves would have in any given situation. That's improv. And so as a stand-up, if something's going on, a joke's not working, or I start doing crowd work, or I'm really relaxed and I'm riffing on my own comments, it's just going to be genuine, and it really helps build up more material mm-hmm. and have a lot more live interaction, and it makes the show seem real. There's no fourth wall. But so that's improv helping stand-up. But stand-up, I think, hurts improv. When I started really doing a ton of stand-up and then started just dabbling with a couple improv shows here or there, I started being more jokey, less genuine, mm-hmm. which kind of kills the life of the scene. It's like, oh, that guy's being a douche.
Yeah, because, I mean, improv, like, funny situations, but you're not really looking punchline, 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 like, every 7 seconds, like, your goal is in stand-up.
Yeah, or even now that I'm doing more stories in my stand-up, I might every 10 seconds, 7 seconds have a reaction, like a character-based reaction. Mm-hmm. Like, what? I couldn't believe I said that. I mean, mm-hmm. that's not a joke, but as a reaction to my story, that might get a laugh. If I start putting jokes in, it's not gonna work on mm-hmm. in the old improv.
So has your very to you influential mother seen your comedy?
No, it's really weird. Initially, she was so supportive of it. Oh, that's great, my son's an artist and so forth. And then when she saw that I became a city guy, you know, like now I have short hair, you know, oh, my son, short hair is so effeminate, you know, like
really.
Well, she's not like all crazy like that, but yeah, in a lot of ways though, she thinks that me on my current path is taking me away from, you know, whatever, taking me away from the true beatnik roots and so forth. Kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine that people who have those thoughts are they're really deeply ingrained in them. So like when they see their kid go off a different direction and become a city boy, that probably is a bit hard to swallow.
Yes.
Where is she located now?
She's in Cooperstown, New York, a little upstate.
Do you ever try to figure out how to get like a show close to her so that she can come and see you?
I will, and I'll let you know.
I mean, is she like? I can't imagine she sits around on the internet looking up clips or something like that.
No. The thing about my mother is she's not just a writer. She's really eccentric. So everything to her is symbolic of something else. Uh-huh. She's like real philosophical, very metaphysical. So if like for example, if she got a sign on her, you know, like on her door saying, you know, your rent's due, you might, you know, you're gonna be evicted or whatever, she'd be like, what does this mean? What is the universe trying to tell me? You know, I'll be like, well, mom, what it means is you gotta pay your rent, uh-huh. you know? So it's all like, everything is like a step removed and metaphysical.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how she is. And so anything practical, like, you know, a setup punch or, oh, here's my struggles, I'm paying my dues, mm-hmm. I, a lot of douchebag bookers, I'm getting a little respect, but it's still hard in certain areas. You know, she'd be like, well, my philosophy is if it's not fun, stop doing it. And, you know, so just quit all that stuff and, you know, come to Cooperstown and, you know, start landscaping and meditate. So a little different mother there.
If only you had stayed with landscaping.
And landscaping is great. So yeah, she's an interesting mother.
How did she take to you getting married and like actually moving on? And that,
oh my god, that was a rough one. My wife and I, we eloped. Actually, we had these plans. It took a couple years. We were engaged, but we just never had we never really had it all together to get the whole party and all the finances that takes and mm-hmm. so forth. So we're just like, screw it. My family's on the East Coast. We're in Chicago. Let's just do it. Let's just, instead of making this big burden on everybody to come here, let's elope. And we did. It was wonderful. And after we eloped, I called my mom and I was like, Mom, Janice and I got married, you know, and her first reaction was, great, when am I going to get married? That was,
wow.
Yeah, I know, I know. Yeah, wow. So, yeah,
kind of where was the metaphysical answer on that one, Mom? I know. But I was like, well, what is this saying to me?
Oh, yeah, well, Brad, what she does is, my mom does positive affirmations, a good thing, I'm into them too.
Right.
But what she does...
Like the whole Stuart Smiley
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, very much, yeah. We used to watch that. She always, she's a fan of that too. But my mom's positive affirmations are passive aggressive. So, yeah, so like one of my sisters went and visited her recently in Cooperstown, and I guess hanging up on the cabinets and on her refrigerator and so forth are signs that say, my children have not abandoned me. Like,
wow.
What?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, she's a loving mother.
Is this a magnet that's on the refrigerator that she just happened upon?
No,
and
no.
Was like, this totally matches what's going on in my life. Right.
The ASPCA thrift shop has the right magnets. she writes those in marker and she hangs them up. And she did that as a kid, too. I'd come home from high school, there'd be a sign that would be like, I got the dream job I've been looking for. And we'd be like, wonderful, finally. We don't have to worry about moving again so quickly. And being evicted, you know, what's the job? And she'd be like, well, you're not supposed to ask me that. You're like, oh, you don't really have a job? She's like, no, that's my affirmation. Stop it. You're checking in too early. It has to incubate. So that was,
That's a rough mom, man.
Yeah, a little. But also on the other hand, very encouraging, even though she hasn't like lit up with accolades about my choice to be a stand-up, neither has she has really said too much. She hasn't really said negative about it. So
she hasn't poo-pooed yet.
She's a poo-pooed about
it. Not yet.
No, but she's supportive of the arts, obviously.
Yeah.
She's a novelist herself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you said that you used to watch like Saturday Night Live with her and those type of things. I didn't think that'd be something like a beatnik person would kind of be into, like having a TV in their house and all that stuff. So was that something that you pushed for as a kid there, or is that something that was just part of the family dynamic?
Family dynamic. She was in a beatnik in the 60s. She was actually a school teacher, so she was a late bloomer herself. So she kind of became
Was like a rigid normie person for a while, and then she kind of rebelled against it.
She did. She, in her mind, the thing that she rebelled against was her Catholic upbringing. She was one of those, you know, she would have been left-handed, but the nuns, you know, slapping the old wrist with the rulers, making her right-handed and so forth. And then when one of her dogs passed away, you know, that brought up the whole, why would God be so cruel?
Mm-hmm.
I'm questioning the church. Why am I not left-handed? I'm hamming it up, being exaggeratory. Mm-hmm. But that was her break, basically. And then we moved from that's when we moved to New Hampshire. I grew up until I was 7 years old in Detroit. So that's when we made the move to the country, and when she really blossomed. So TVs were a thing of her upbringing.
To move on, what are you doing here in LA now? I mean, how are you spending your time in making the Jeb Cadwell brand better?
The one thing I'm doing is I'm always writing. So I'm keeping sharp, and I'm hitting a lot of open mics and little showcases to keep sharp. I'm not doing, like before I moved out here, 20, 30 weeks a year, 4 or 5 hours a week on stage. So I hear it's been a decrease of stage time, but I look at it kind of like Candyland. A couple, two steps forward, one step back.
Paula Abdul. You know,
is that one of her songs?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Who's Paula Abdul?
Paula Abdul, she was the...
she was the hostess that just got fired, or the judge that just got fired off of...
American Idol.
Yeah. American Idol.
I jest. My mother had a Paula Abdul positive affirmation, so I
Really?
I know the reference.
You were a Lakers fan, and you remember her as a Laker girl, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Yes, there we go.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, out here, I'm still doing a lot of stand-up. It's doing little shows at the Improv, at the sometimes the Comedy Store, up in the Belly Room. A lot of really good little showcases, a lot of obscure showcases.
Love the Belly Room. One of my favorite places.
It's fun. It's really relaxed.
Yeah.
It's really relaxed. The original room, one of my least favorite places.
A lot of stress in there.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of weird.
Yeah.
But, so I'm also writing. I have a blog called karmalampoon.com. JebCadwell.com routes to it. And what that is, it's comedy which focuses on a more specific genre. So it's sort of like The Onion, the satirical newspaper or website. Mixed with or meets like an eco journal or a yoga journal or some kind of enlightenment quest. So obviously my mother's upbringing did influence me to have these enlightening thoughts and so forth. So that's my brand of comedy, and Karma Lampoon has a lot of comedy like that. So it's, you know, comedy about soul searching, comedy about getting rid of any preconceived notions and stepping out into the unknown. Very, very Kerouac influenced comedy, I'd say. And so I'm developing that with the idea that it's going to evolve to its own genre. That's when I do my road tours so far, I feel hit any audience. I do corporate shows or blue collar shows or college shows.
Yeah, I saw you do corporate shows like you do roasts of people.
Yeah.
How do you get into a situation like that where you know how far you can push something with somebody? Do you have to run your jokes past them first? Because that kind of takes the sting and the fun out of it.
Yeah, it does. Sometimes it edges on getting too far, but you always check in first. When I do a roast, I have a information sheet. I give the people, hey, give me info. Here's 50 questions on whoever we're roasting. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the people are in on it, sometimes they're not. So I just ask what's appropriate.
I did my first roast this summer of somebody who was a friend of mine. And I wrote all these just terribly awful with the person. Then as I got closer to it, I'm starting to feel like, oh man, I can't really say these things about my friend in public. But I went ahead and did it anyways because I'm a bad person and it was wonderful. Nice. Like, roasting people is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's easy. It's really easy too.
Really easy.
Because you don't really have to stretch. It's just like, oh, this guy's got bedhead. Like, oh, that's great. Well, that'd be pretty weak.
But. Yeah, well, whatever you want to go after. Like, wearing a pink shirt. I mean, whatever it is, like, you can head off that direction. How does your wife deal with your stand-up? Is she ever referenced in your comedy? Like, does she...
She is referenced in my comedy. Chris Rock helped me a lot. I haven't met or worked with Chris Rock, but something he said in an interview once, talking when he talks about his wife on stage, he says that he's got his real wife and his stage wife. So when he's talking wife on stage, that's his stage wife, which is a layer removed. So once I expressed to my wife, like, when I'm talking on stage, this is my stage wife. This isn't my real
Brilliant.
Wife.
Brilliant.
She's able to kind of relax into a little bit. But
I'm having that issue right now with mine. Because she's only been dealing with my stand-up for about a year and a half now.
Right.
And now she's getting to the point where it's like her friends are coming up and they're like, he was making fun of you on this and he was making fun of you on that. And I'm trying to explain to her, like, it's not really you that I'm making fun of. It's just a funny situation. And
I'm telling you an anecdote that I found amusing and other people find amusing as well.
It's a tough line at home.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. My wife deals with, she likes it. She doesn't come to my shows that much. And that's actually a lot of times she's like, should I come into this one? And I like to kind of keep it a little separate so I don't feel like the number one person who's counting on me to be good so that eventually we can have an improved lifestyle. Like, I don't want to have that pressure. Like, that joke didn't work, but it doesn't matter because Lauren Michael wasn't here tonight or whatever the situation. So, but I do know, I married a beautiful woman, and she's a yoga studio. When I mentioned earlier getting hurt doing the protesting, that led me into physical therapy, which got me into yoga, and that's how I met my wife. And so she has a lot of similar, well, open-minded principles that my mom has, about you create your own reality, your thoughts will manifest what you desire and so forth. So the one thing that my wife does not like at all is if I do jokes about being poor. I'll go out and I'll do jokes being like, I'm so broke, if I want a hot lunch, I got to fart on my peanut butter and jelly, But, she'd be like, that's what you're telling the universe. And so, like, I get this whole, like, what vibe are you putting out after I kill for 10 minutes?
Must be positive comedy.
Yes, yes.
Positive comedy.
Everything is so okay that I don't have a premise to lean on. Everything's great.
I love my wife, and that's what's great. There are no problems for me to tell you about at home.
After the show, I'm going to get in my car that works just fine and drive home without getting pulled over by the cops.
And then tomorrow I'm going to go to the job that I love so very, very much.
Have you ever really said a joke that was too far for your wife?
Gosh, I think she's listening, Jake. Uh-huh. Yeah, so no.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Got
it. I'm glad you're listening. Thanks.
Yeah. I don't think so. Once I got to the stage wife part, it was pretty good.
You'll get done and there'll be a text message on your phone going, remember that one time?
Oh, yeah, that one joke. But I have.
Because they do never forget.
They do. I think, my wife's on my side. She's on my team. But you mentioned one of your wife's friends. So I had a situation. I had a buddy, funny stand-up comic. He had a psycho girlfriend in Chicago who ended up embezzling. Like she was actually had an alias, wasn't the right person.
Wow.
They got together for a year, and then she stole like $60,000 from him. Mm-hmm. And I
Ouch.
And I suspected right when they first started dating. I was like, dude, there's something wrong with this chick. And because like whatever, we'd be driving three people in the front of a moving van, helping them move into their apartment. She's like, a cop's coming. Let me out. I'm like, is she hiding from something? But she was trying to keep him away from his buddies. So she was putting a wedge. And so she'd hear my shows and then she would be texting my wife and calling our phone being like, your husband, he's making jokes about you. He's saying horrible things like you like knickknacks.
Oh like, my God, that's
oh
awful.
Oh my goodness, I know. So whew, the knickknack thing.
Yeah,
almost.
I called mine a pedophile on stage.
Oh yeah, well Saturday that's. Night. Well, they're pedophilia knickknacks. So
oh, they exist. Well, we really appreciate you coming in here today,
thank
man.
You.
Once
thank
again,
you
where
so
can
much.
People learn more about you?
Oh, where they can learn more about me?
Yeah.
They can go to JebCadwell.com or KarmaLampoon.com, and that's where you see my schedule. I'm doing some shows on May 24th and 25th. 24th at the Belly Room. It's a great Chicago show. A lot of good acts up there. It's at 10 p.m. and 25th at midnight at the Improv Lab. Should be a good time. And yeah.
I think we're going to get you in on our show on the 19th.
Nice.
We'll talk about that of May. So
wonderful.
We'll talk about that when we get off. One last question we always
sure.
like to ask people. This will probably be a slightly more difficult one. Do you have any like television guilty pleasures that you're into?
Yeah. Right now, my biggest television guilty pleasure is catching up on all the stuff that I missed when I was in the wilderness for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
So. Like I'm talking to my friends being like, oh, have you seen the first season of The Office?
Uh-huh.
You know? like, yeah.
Dude, we saw that seven? Like 8 years ago when it first was on. That's great.
Everyone's talking about current shows, and I'm just like, oh my God, Lost? This show's going somewhere. And so like my guilty pleasure is just being like a little
bit. It's catching
behind.
Up on all the old series that we've all already seen.
So. Yeah.
In some way, I'm kind of jealous of that though, because you get to see, like you still get to experience those things for new. Like when I talked to this girl on the train the other day, and just this dumb chick, probably like 24 years old. And I'm like, oh yeah, I made the Star Wars reference. She's like, what's that? I'm like, Star Wars? I don't know what that is. I'm like, okay, look. You may not know what the original Star Wars movies are, but you have to at least know what the last three, I mean, with the little Anakin and like, no, I have no idea what that is. And I told her, I'm jealous of you because you get to experience that now for the first time and get to see it and live through it.
Yeah. I'm jealous of the fact that she gets to watch 4, 5, and 6 for the first time. Yeah, not overly jealous of her having to watch 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
Like, hey, enjoy those. Thumbs up,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, she watches 1 and she's talking about Jar Jar.
Exactly.
Oh, this is good. This Rasta guy.
Awful. And then to see the step back in technology when it comes to filmmaking, when you get to 4, and for us growing up, that was the top of the line. I mean, the original Death Star explosion when it was just a model hanging there and it blew up, and they didn't have the added effect of that ring that goes around and spreads out throughout the universe. It's like there's a complete and wonderful difference about them. So, but thanks again for coming in, man. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Much appreciated, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, I have a slight technical difficulty in here, guys. Somehow, I have knocked out the signal to my computer screen, so I have no idea what's going on in here for me able to pull myself into a break. We'll figure out here pretty quick, I'm sure. Before, I guess we can do that. Hey, I guess we're going to get forced to stay on the air for a second or two.
That was all I prepared.
Crazy news story came out yesterday that really is disturbing to me, and I'm not sure where to put this. The state of New York has now ruled that a child pornography viewing is not illegal.
What?
Like, you can now view as much child porn as you want. Only thing you can't do is download it or I guess, like, download.
You can't actively be downloading it.
What? Right.
Because what happens is, in the case that they're talking about, there was a university teacher who had visited sites, but what happens is when you visit sites, certain pictures are cached right into your files on your computer. So they found all these photos, but they weren't actively downloaded. He didn't put them into a file specifically. The computer did it because it as like a backup kind of thing to that, where are we when during a system break? And so what they're saying is the viewing of it is not illegal itself as long as you're not actively downloading it. But the question is if you're actively seeking that out, isn't
like
that
putting it into like a search engine?
Putting it into a search engine or putting it into your ISP address box, your ISP address box or whatever it is. Yeah. That right there is the act of trying to find that. And I mean,
I've heard people use things as an excuse, like, I was molested when I was a kid, I was trying to like look up and see what happened to other people so I can mentally get back to where it works for me. Or I had pictures taken of me when I was young, so I was trying to see if they were out there and I was being exploited. But this whole thing of you are allowed to look at it is a complete change, because it's always just been viewing of it is a legal offense. Mm-hmm. At least that's what's always been said.
Right.
Yeah, it should be.
So, yeah, it is really strange because it makes you wonder what the next step is. There will be legislation because this has happened. There will be probably very quick legislation. At least we'll hear about it getting started in Congress, and then we'll see how many months it takes, but in which they're going to probably try to say the actual act of viewing this and searching it out is in itself where the first offense is.
As well, it should be. I mean, it's some of the most defenseless people on the planet, and now the courts are saying that it's okay to exploit them and to pleasure out of exploiting them.
I don't think that's what the courts are saying. They're saying that because by putting it up, just posting it is also illegal. So these sites that are up illegally with child porn on them are, in a sense, they are already illegal because they've been downloaded onto a site.
Okay, so that makes sense to me.
So it's the actual act of if he's looking through this, they can't say that the act of searching is wrong, because like you said, it could have been quite simply that I was looking up stories about child pornography and, you know, the effects that it has on children. And it brought me to certain, you know, websites that had a photo that I went away from, but my computer didn't actively download it. It just saved that picture on there. So when you found these pictures on my computer, they weren't ones that I was actively downloading. I was doing something else, and they happened to be cached into my computer. So that's they're not saying. It's just really strange how vague the court is now making it. Wow. They're saying that the legislature is going to have to make a major change in the state of New York to try and stop this altogether.
There's something else in New York. It was about 2 months ago. There's a guy who's defending himself for child pornography charges. He's been in jail because he's his own attorney. He gets to watch all of his own child porn again, just to, you know, so we can review the evidence.
I believe, Jake, we never actually talked about it on the air, but that was one of the stories we remember a couple of months back that were, you know, potential stories to talk about. That's right. There was that guy who was allowed to like, because he was his own attorney, be able to go back and look at all the evidence again.
Man, that's crazy.
It's sick.
At that point, I would almost like rather just say, okay, we're going to drop the charges against you so that you can't view these things again.
Right.
And if we catch you, like we know that you're totally into this stuff, you trickster.
Trickster,
yeah, that's what I've got for calling out child pornographers. Yeah. Get out of here, you little trickster.
That's for kids.
That's awful. Okay, so I think that we have our technical difficulties under control. Once again, we really do appreciate you, Jeb, coming in here. Thank you, guys. And so I didn't even ask, do you tweet or anything like that?
Yeah, it's at Karma Lampoon.
All right.
Karma Lampoon.
We will make sure that we throw a link up on that for our show page so nice. People can find you easier.
Nice, I'm following you, so check out Grand Theft Audio's, who's following them. You'll see me.
Excellent.
Right on.
So here's another track from Mae McDonough, as we've said, and Company. Yes, I think that this is actually one of her
solos.
One of her solo tracks. Yeah,
single. Yeah,
and check it out, and we will be back. Right, what's going on here? I got some weird thing going on. Sorry, guys. Where'd it go? There we go. Load up, sucker. It's not working. Okay, we'll talk for one more second. Hey, and you're out of here in 10, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. May has actually played a few of our shows before. They have a really weird vibe to them. They bring out a whole bunch of different...
not exactly instruments.
Yeah, but they play things.
Yeah, they, exactly. That's a good way of putting it is you know, like barrels and tubs and glass bottles and such. To use those as percussion instruments at times. But we at our good friend Carl's birthday party, they put on a really nice show for us there. That was a lot of fun. Looking forward to having them in tomorrow morning.
I got the track ready.
Awesome.
This is Riverside by Mae McDonough. Back right after this. a text from Cheryl in the middle of that. Can you hear me on here?
No.
You can't. Yeah, that's bad.
And that was Mae McDonough and her song Riverside. And
she has such beautiful composition to her music. That there's such emotion in all of it.
I love her voice. Her voice is just wonderful to listen to. So
very similar to me to like a Fiona Apple type feeling.
Very much so. Well, at this point, I have to get going because I've got work this afternoon. But before I go, I thought it'd be really great to let everyone hear some of Jed's stand-up. And we were able to find a little spot here. So this is our... our guest for the day, Jeb Cadwell, and this is, what's the name of this one?
This is his 400th set, and it's called Spirituality.
Awesome.
A lot of people have asked me about doing 400 shows in 10 months. They're like, that must be a spiritual experience for you, you know? Like, I'm trying to figure out, like, what is spirituality? It's so subjective. How do you define it, you know? I find, like, a lot of people doing spiritual things just means doing more of what they already do. Like hedonism, right? Yeah. That's right. Well, actually, in my dream, everyone went, hedonism! It's like my mom. I asked my mom, like, I'm like, are you spiritual? She's like, yeah. I'm like, what's that mean? She's like, pack a day. I was telling her I was practicing meditation. She's like, I meditate. I'm like, what tradition? She goes, I watch the smoke. my dad's like the opposite of like what you would coin spiritual. Like, we talk about things like spark plugs. I asked him if he's spiritual. He's like, yeah. I'm like, what's that? He goes, pyramids. We don't know how they got here, but I believe in them. Keep working on it. Like, if you get more spiritual, what's that? He goes, UFOs. Like, some people, it's church, and I'm cool with that. I saw a little church down the street, though. A sign said, join our non-denominational congregation. And then I thought, yeah, they probably also don't have a numerator. I know some people, their version of spirituality is like being connected to the earth. And like I dated this hippie chick one time, and like for her that meant not wasting her monthly cycle on tampons. I know. She's like, I collect my menses in a cheesecloth and I wring it out over tomatoes. I was like, that's too much info. I just had gazpacho. It's just well, the dream, the joke didn't work that well. I'm still happy. Yeah, like feeding tomatoes with a I know next time I have ketchup, I'm gonna be like, oh, I swear I tasted a 58th variety. Yeah. I know, like some people, their version of like spirituality means like they miss their own wild side, so they all believe their dogs are part wolf. And all these people are like, yeah, 1/17th, you know. Like, first of all, it looks like a poodle. Second of all, how do you know the genealogy of a dog you got out of a dumpster looking for food? Third of all, how can a genealogy be an odd number, you know? And they all name their animals after Hindu deities. It's like, it's so weird hearing people being like, Shiva, get out of the litter box! I'm like, isn't Shiva the destroyer of all, you know, like, that's a 5,000-year-old tradition? You know, so what do you mean? Krishna, stop chasing traffic! Like, I'm sure over in India there's like a Hindu hippie, and he's going, stop pumping my leg, Jesus! St. Peter, stop licking your balls. All this stuff, yeah. You know, for me, like, you gotta be, to be, like, holy, you gotta be healthy, they say, you know? So, like, I worry about health sometimes. And, yeah, like, I'm a hypochondriac almost, you know? And I got friends, they go, don't worry about it, because everything that happens in your body is just a product of your mind. I'm like, ooh, must have been something I was thinking. mental combination or something. I don't know. Actually, I'm the kind of guy that, like, when I'm gonna fart, I like to warn people about it, but I also like to blame it on the dog. So I often end up going, "Oh, guys, I think the dog's about to fart." I do. I got a golden retriever. That dog has the biggest heart, you know. But that's what happens when they get Lyme tick's disease, you know. We had a thing in my elementary school called health fair days, and in those classes, the definition of health meant the lack of lice and scoliosis. You know, I was like, I didn't know what scoliosis meant, but I thought it meant smart because we had these things called scholastic readers. But I was like, how was it? I'm like, they said I'm scoliastic. I actually liked the lice check because it was this very like maternal heavyset woman whose breasts touched my shoulder blades as she, you know, sat behind me and sifted through my hair with chopsticks. So now every time I eat Kung Pao chicken, I crave a head rub. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to live and work and be, you know, like spiritually fulfilled. And I was thinking, like, part of me wants to be, you know, help society, like, be a police officer. Like, the other part wants to be a yoga teacher. So I'm sure, like, if I combine them together, I'd be like, "Sir, yep, up against the wall right now. Yep, no funny business. Raise your arms slowly over your head. Good. Roll your shoulder blades back and ground into the ball mounts of your feet. All right. Start this arrest with an ohm."
"I cannot go on.
Go on.
I question the existence of God and curse him and his son's name.
Jesus Christ.
That's right. Can there be no relief from life's daily struggles for someone like me?
It seems doubtful.
All I need is one reason not to slice my wrists and donate my body to necrophiliacs."
"Ah. The old commit suicide and donate your body to the sex pervert's dilemma. We have all been there."
"Have we?"
"Sure we have. I have hope for you, stranger. Let me tell you my tale."
Saddest stories I've ever heard in my life. I love it, though. Hey, this is Jake Belcher. You're back with Grand Theft Audio Radio. I sadly am all alone. So that's when we kick it over to... I don't have to deal with what Brant wants to talk about. I no longer have to deal with what our old co-host Carl wants to talk about. It's whatever I want to talk about. So some of the things that are getting at me today are Canadians. You know, not a fan of you Canadians. I'm not sure exactly what it is you provide that's of value to the Northern Hemisphere. I would actually rank you in order of importance to us as Americans first, then Mexicans, then Greenlanders, then Canadians. Seems to me like a Canada, you just kind of sit there. You don't do very much. You make syrup. I guess you've got policemen on horses, mounted horsemen, which is a little bit of a weird thing to call it, like mounted police. It should be like a horsed police or something. Like, mounted has this weird connotation to it that I would not want to mess with a mounted cop. We've also got new money. Your new money looks fucking ridiculous. I can't tell you how many colors are on it. The only thing that I really like about it, it's the only money in the world that I know of that has bare breasts on it. Totally into that. That way I could take the $20 boob bill and I could shove it down some $20 dancer's top, and I feel like that kind of keeps the balance to the universe. I mean, there's not much else I can say about you that's good. You put up with the French to the point that you let them come into your country and talk in their own language and make you feel like you're less of a person and less of a people. I just have to really question French people and their want of even being in Canada. It seems like it's an awful place. There's probably 10 square miles that are nice somewhere in Vancouver. I think maybe you have a SeaWorld. I mean, SeaWorlds are pretty awesome, but I can't think of any other reason that
anybody would want to go there. Maple syrup, lot of grizzly bears, the police who ride the horses. Canada is a suck-ass place. Anybody who has any talent leaves it very quickly and comes to America because the idea of making it in Canada is, it's like the opposite of that New York song, you know. If you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere. Like Canada's like, if you can make it there, no one gives a shit because it's fucking Canada. It is the North American hellhole. I would much rather spend all my time and all my money down in Mexico. We can have fun. Canada is cold. It's full of I hate the French so fucking much. And the fact that you people take them in and think, oh yeah, these guys are great. Like, we don't care if they shit all over our culture and they start this stuff called Cirque du Soleil. Have you seen Cirque du Soleil? It is like a gay orgy on acid with stuff getting shot in your face. It's really, really over the top and awful. Can't stand you, Canada. Get out of here, Canada. I'm going to officially kick you off of this continent right now. I'm going to go up there and build a fence or put some explosives along the border to make it so you can't come in. I'm sick of your bullshit. You can keep sending people over for Saturday Night Live. You can do that. You can send us your Michael J. Foxes and the people who actually have some type of skill, and you can keep your shitty French clowns, and you can keep your... Let's be honest. Maple syrup is not even good. I mean, I don't know what other type of syrups there are that aren't maple, but they're always better. Maple syrup is the most disappointing syrup you could possibly get. I'd rather have something with some blueberry flavor or some strawberry. Your stupid Canadian pride in your maple syrup is disgusting to me. Just like your mounted police, your salmon, your poor excuses for sports teams. I mean, have you ever done anything, Canada? You should just fucking quit. Kill yourself, Canada. Get yourself like a giant razor blade that can cut across the wrists of the entire country at one time and just put me out of my misery and thinking you exist. Okay, you do a couple of things when I think about it. You've done a very good job of making the world of professional wrestling better, and I appreciate that. You have Chris Benoit, who came out of your lovely little place called Ottawa, which is, I think, the only place that doesn't allow people to speak French in Canada. So I like that. You also have the Hart Foundation, Bret Hart. He came out of there. So you got about three things going for you, Canada. You got the people that you've provided for Saturday Night Live. You've got professional wrestlers. And no, that's it. Just two things. It's only two things, Canada. If you had anything else going for you, I would say that it is time not to kill yourself. But that is all you've got with your bears and your eating salmon right out of the river. And I just don't know why anybody would even want to go and visit you. It's just clean and it's just full of people who talk with A's, and I can't get behind it. I mean, have you heard of Mexico? Mexico is incredible. You walk the streets of Mexico and people come up to you and like, hey man, you want to get some mota? Hey man, you want to get some yayo? Hey man, you want some sex? That doesn't happen in Canada. It's like when you walk up down the streets in Canada, people are like, hey, take me home with you. We hate it here. We don't want to be here any more than you do. I mean, how did you come here to Canada? Did you lose a bet? Does your company suck and they couldn't afford to have a convention in like a nice country, so they sent you here? Canada, you're awful. You're easily my third favorite country in the Northern Hemisphere. Northern, North Pacific. It's USA number one, Mexico number two, Canada last place. Like, okay, maybe there are a couple of other things when I think about it. Maybe SCTV was okay. But even then, I think you probably had, like, American writers come over there and write some good stuff for you, because there's no way that you as a collective group came up with that awesome show on your own. And I guess I like Trailer Park Boys. Dang it. The more I think about Canada, the more I realize I don't want all of you to kill yourselves. Just the people who make maple syrup. And the people who try to put down professional wrestling.
Hey, look, this is Jake Belcher's headband. These are the things that I think about all the time. And I really do walk around with an irrational hate of Canada. I can't really explain why. I think probably because I don't have to deal with Canadians that much. I've gotten so used to living here in Southern California and being like, oh, yeah, Mexicans everywhere. Like, I like your food and I like your music and all that other stuff. But you Canadians don't provide any of that stuff. Has anybody out there tried to eat plantains or whatever those things are called, poutines with their, basically their French fries with like cheese curds on it. It's disgusting. They put brown HP sauce gravy on top of everything that just kills all the flavor. I mean, can't you figure out how to make something good? I've never had someone say, oh, that fine Canadian chef brought in some great meal, because it doesn't happen. Like, I don't think you guys know how to barbecue properly. I think that your food is booty. Your music is worse. Anything that's good out of Canada instantly comes to America and pretends that it was never in Canada. You can't even get Cirque du Soleil to admit that they came from you anymore. Like, you talk to the people who run it, and they're like, did you come from Canada? They're like, oh, no, we didn't. We came from Montreal, which is the French part, which is like little baby foreign Canada. I just don't get why you let other people come in your country and do that. And seriously, like, develop a palate, develop some type of redeeming quality about you that makes people think, oh, yeah, I like Canada. I can totally deal with this. Instead, you just keep on sending that syrup down and that, no, oh, what was that, those mounted police with Tom Slicker or something like that. I don't even know, like, do you make cartoons in Canada? Do you make good entertainment? I have no idea what the number one rated television show is in Canada. It's probably not Kenny versus Spenny, which is awesome from Canada, but I think that you guys kicked that off the air because Canada has no damn taste. Hate Canada. I spend an irrational amount of time thinking about how much I hate Canada. It's probably because all the people I ever meet from Canada are old. You never meet young people from Canada, like, where they come down like, oh yeah, we're off on vacation, we're having a good time and enjoying ourselves. It's old people who want to get out of the shitty snow and the weather, and it's just awful. I don't understand you, Canada. Can you tell me one redeeming quality about Canada? Probably not, because they don't exist. That is today's irrational hate of another country. And today's subject, in case you didn't know it, was Canada. Tomorrow, I'll probably switch my entire thing around and say how much I love Canada and how much I hate Mexico, because I'll probably get inundated with people who say, oh, no, this is great about Canada and that's great about Canada, but I doubt it. Stupid Canada. I hate you. Dirty, freaking stupid Canucks. You play that game hockey. Ooh, that's a great game. Just run around on some ice and you try to throw it in the net. Not even very exciting. You don't have girls who come out and dance on the ice after every score. You don't have anything that's good about it. I mean, you have people getting in fights, and that's kind of cool for like 10 seconds, as long as you're not the one who's getting your teeth punched out. But you don't really have to worry about getting your teeth punched out if you're Canadian, because you probably already lost them. You know, that maple sugar and eating wood, biting into things like you're a beaver. This is Canadian people. You're not beavers. You don't have to carve things with your teeth. You can use a knife and whittle. You can not have to spend your time thinking that you're some 1800s craftsman who hasn't even invented a knife yet, and you want to make some bone carving of a whale. Like, we don't care, Canada. Keep your imports. You'd never go to Pier 1 and see, oh, that beautiful thing was made in Canada. It doesn't happen. I'm not sure what you people do, how you spend your time. Probably watching hockey, drinking maple syrup, watching bears in your backyard because they're not afraid of you Canadians of doing anything. Seems like an awful existence. Not a fan, Canada. But I am a fan of your new $20 bill. The fact that you have boobs on your money is incredible. Like, I don't even want to go and get rid of it at a strip club now. I just want to put up a whole bunch of them on the wall and I can stare at it and I'll be like, yeah, that is a retirement plan I can totally get behind. I guess that's all I really have on Canada. I didn't even think about talking about Canada when I came in here today. What made me think about Canada? I guess that guy, Jeb Cadwell, our guest today, said that he went up there once, and I realized, yeah, I guess I can talk about Canada for a minute. I promise that tomorrow I will not talk about Canada at all unless it blows up tonight or something goes really, really wrong. And also on tomorrow's show, Fuck Around Friday, which seems like it may have started a little early this week, we have live in studio Mae McDonough and company. We're also bring back in Rachel Butera. She talked to some people after our interview last week with Max Hardcore that she wants to be able to get off her chest, and she'll be pretty awesome. So if you get a chance, come back tomorrow. Tell your friends. Go to Facebook.com/ Grand Theft Audio, and also check out Skid Row Studios and learn more about them and their shows. So catch you guys tomorrow. Bye.